Hello, guys.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Monuments, Museums, and Mojitos podcast. I'm Izan.
I'm Nikki.
I'm Polly.
And together we're coming back to you for the first time in forever. Apologies, friends, family, listeners, and everyone else. But yeah, it's been a little while, but we're back with a special Christmas episode.
This wasn't a psychological trick to desire us more, you know? How sometimes you have to make someone reject to reject someone to make them want you more.
Well, like, treat him mean, keep him keen.
Yeah. It was just us being inconsistent.
It's been quite a big year for all of us for different reasons. A lot's changed in our lives. Professionally, mainly.
We had to travel a lot, all of us, this year.
This year's been a massive travel year. Polly with work, Izan with work, me with work. Yeah. I mean, combined, we've probably gone to like 100 different destinations.
Yeah. Maybe, just yeah.
Polly went all the way to Australia at the start of the year.
Yeah.
I did, actually. Yeah. Actually, my parents came to take me from the airport when I arrived because they were quite nervous if I'm going to come back alive.
No, like,
yeah.
You were fine. You were well taken care of.
I was, yeah. Now is the Christmas period.
Yeah, and so we're coming at you with a bit of a festive-themed episode today.
Yeah.
And we also have a festive drink.
We do have a festive drink, and we were all a bit shocked that we hadn't done this drink before because it's one of me and Izan's favorites. We are drinking a Christmassy glue wine.
Woo-hoo.
Or mulled wine, as us.
Yep.
Yeah.
As non-Germans say.
As Anglophiles would say.
Yeah.
Probably like Glühwein.
Glühwein.
So we are getting in the Christmas spirit. We've been going to Christmas markets here in Athens as well. And the nice thing about Christmas this year is actually we're all going to be in the same city for it. So it's an extra sort of nice and appropriately themed episode.
Definitely, because this is going to be the first time we're all kind of together for Christmas.
True, yeah.
So we've got our cheese and crackers, we've got our mulled wine.
Yeah.
We're having a very kind of cozy time with our knitwear on and
We just lack central heating in Athens.
Oh, you're asking for
not
a
everything
lot now.
Can be perfect, no.
Yeah, no, we've got a candle though. The central heating might come on soon, actually. But thermals, Ugg boots.
Yeah.
And it's not snowing here, like it's still okay for now.
It's not even cold, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's a bit cold today.
A little bit. But you know, mulled wine, alcohol.
Yeah.
So what's our episode
does
about?
The job. So today we are going on a little Christmas adventure. We are going to walk through history and talk about some significant events that have happened on Christmas Day, December 25th, that Christmas Day, throughout history. Each of us have chosen one topic each. I am going to be talking about sort of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Very cheery and Christmassy.
Yeah. I think Polly's gets a little bit more cheery. Polly, what are you talking about?
I'm going to talk about the execution and trial of Ceausescu. Basically, the trial and execution of Ceausescu.
And mine is slightly more cheery. I'm going to be talking about the coronation of Charlemagne.
Ooh, the rapper.
Not the rapper.
No.
The king of the Franks. Well, you know, okay. Same. All I'm right. Sure they both had a lot of gold, so.
Them chains, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's get into it.
Okay, so Nikki, tell us about the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, okay. Well, I should begin by maybe pointing out why its relevancy falls on Christmas Day. So basically, who else would have such a monumentally politically significant event happen on Christmas Day? The Soviet Union, who didn't celebrate or believe in Christmas. We just want to point this out. Which begs the question, can we call it a Christmas Day event for a nation that didn't actually believe in Christmas? But anyway,
it happened on 25th of December.
That
so
is the
that
generally consensus of the date agreed upon for Christmas, so we'll just go with that. So in short, basically, the once great union of communist states finally said their official farewell from their comradeship on December 25th, 1991, after the resignation of their then and last leader, Mikhail Gorbachev. So just a little bit of background about Gorbachev. He was the last leader of the Soviet Union, and he assumed that leadership in March of 1985. But by this point, he had inherited quite a worn-out and kind of stagnant and stagnant economy and political structure of the Soviet Union. You might know him for his most famous types of attempted reforms, the first being Glasnost.
Or the commercials of Pizza Hut and Louis Vuitton.
We're getting there. Yeah. But his political significance basically falls under his two attempted reforms, which is Glasnost, which was political openness, and Perestroika, which was economic restructuring. These reforms, though, were quite slow to reap any positive outcomes, and the long brewing need for the union's members to have their independence finally led to his Christmas Day resignation. In his farewell address, he stated that the old system collapsed before the new one had time to begin working. I think we'd all say that if we tried something and it failed. Wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Anyway, props to him. And basically it was a peaceful end to what had been a long, terrifying, and sometimes bloody epoch in human history. The collapse and fall of the Soviet Union.
Do you think he tried to do too much at once, or he did too little too late? Do we know? Do we know what the...
I think maybe he tried to do too much too late. The system was already very, very dysfunctional.
Think about the leaders before him and what they had done.
And he had there was a war with Afghanistan back then also, so huge economic troubles, I guess, to maintain a war. But funny thing, he always believed in communism, actually. He was really, or socialism, he was really convinced that there is a future for that type of system. He really believed in Lenin. Like, he was very convinced that he can make it work by preserving the, I don't know, the traditional idea of the Soviet Union. But I guess it was too late.
He did have to deal and try and reform some of the very hardcore and in some cases brutal legislation that had existed since the times of Joseph Stalin.
Yeah. I mean, there was this thing that they were broadcasting live parliamentary sessions back then, and people in Russia have never seen that. And
oh, wow.
They could see for the first time these absurd people, these MPs, they are arguing about absurd stuff, and it's like you see how the image that you have of your country, you know, somehow, like, I know, disintegrates, you know, because you see all these people arguing in parliament, being super dysfunctional, like, it's
just being regular human beings.
Yeah,
basically.
Just being regular human beings. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess by trying to reform such a overcooked, say, political structure, he was actually quite well appreciated by the West, which of course none of the other Soviet leaders were. They were surprise enemies for decades. But yeah, he is dubbed as the most West-friendly leader of the USSR. Yeah. And things like the Glasnost and Perestroika contributed to this image. And he was sort of hands-on with, like, the former enemy. He comfortably slid into an American multinational restaurant chain Pizza Hut commercial, which was filmed in Moscow but not actually shown there.
Oh,
really?
Well, shown in Russia generally, yeah. And he campaigned also for Louis Vuitton. I actually don't know what this is. What did he do for Louis Vuitton?
He did a commercial for them.
Was he modeling?
No. From what I remember, I think he was quite old back then. This was in the 2000s, maybe? 2005, 6?
2007, yeah.
Yeah, and he... I think from the commercial, I think he entered into a very luxurious car and, I don't know, something like that. Like,
Jesus, Louis Vuitton's like the pinnacle image of capitalism, pretty much.
But yeah, also they, because of obviously his popularity in the West and trying to open the Soviet Union, he's not very popular in Russia. Actually, Putin blames him to be one of the bad presidents, you know, like one of the reasons why Russia is losing its credibility and power. And Yeah, because following Gorbachev, there was a total disintegration of the Soviet Union, many of like Ukraine gained independence, Belarus.
Oh yeah, you can sort of slap his name to that easily.
Yeah, yeah. Economically, Russia struggled a lot in the 90s.
He,
Actually,
fun fact about him and Putin's sort of relationship or Putin's view of Gorbachev. Gorbachev actually refused to send the Red Army into Eastern Europe to save the communist bloc. And Putin, before he was obviously president, was stationed with the KGB in East Germany. And he is supposedly said to have felt the sting of Moscow's desertion in this sense. And yeah, he came to see the demise of the Soviet Empire as a disaster in history. And of course, once he regained power, what has he set out to do?
Conquer those territories.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, lol, but not lol.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, or what goes around comes around.
Yeah.
And it was it Yeltsin who took over power in Russia after that?
Yeah.
But he was more of a kind of radical in terms of...
I mean, he was very... Also, this was the growth of populism, not populism, sorry, of nationalism back then. So
yeah.
It was very... And radical capitalist reforms, you know... The oligarchs were more or less created back then.
Yeah.
And I think Russia lost more than 30% of its GDP.
Mm.
Oh. I mean, their economic crisis in the 90s was bigger than the US economic crisis during the Great Depression. So you can imagine, yeah, how tough were the years. And this is following Gorbachev's rule, obviously, you know, like, I mean, yeah.
We might... in the West view him with rose-tinted glasses because it brought the Cold War to a close.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was quite lenient in his dealings with the West. But actually, when you look at it from a Russian standpoint, you can see why people wouldn't view him with such a rosy view. They would
be
a lot harsher.
I think in general, this period is interesting. And maybe we need to do a separate podcast on that. But there is some coup d'etat going on. There are some tanks also involved, Yeltsin trying to gain power, the same time the communist establishment tries to preserve itself in power. Like, it's an interesting, very dynamic period.
Yeah.
These early 90s.
And
yeah.
Soviet leaders trying to rebrand themselves as nationalists so that retain power in a different format.
Yeah.
So they don't just fall into, like, obscurity and probably get accused of crimes.
Yeah.
Corruption, etc.
Yeah, and that's certainly got its legacy until today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's probably going to go down as the most West friendly, tried to change but didn't manage, and end of Soviet Union forever.
Yeah.
We hope. Leader.
On another communist leader.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who didn't have a very... I don't know, happy end. I mean, because in the end, yeah, Gorbachev kind of managed to stay relevant. He lived long, right?
He died peacefully and only died last year in 2022.
Did he stay in Russia or did he, like...
Yeah, I think he stayed in Russia. Yes, yes,
I think
yes.
He did, yeah.
He lived in Russia, yeah. For a long time, yeah.
Yeah, he died in Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He was just not very... I think he didn't get a lot of visibility in the media. Like, he just stayed in his house, in his apartment, getting his nice pension, I guess, and just living his life, you know?
He got a Nobel Peace Prize. Who hands them out? The West?
Like, So, another communist leader who didn't have this happy... And following his career as a politician was Ceaușescu, and I'm going to speak about him now. So, I mean, we all know Ceaușescu, guys, right? Like,
don't think we do. Who was he?
He was the Romanian, basically, dictator. He governed Romania, I think, for 25 years during communism. So, he actually died. He was not, no, he didn't die. He was actually killed on Christmas Day in 1989.
Ooh.
So, long story short, Romania, he was a, I mean, massive dictator. His wife also, in the 60s and 70s, Romania was kind of doing okay in terms of economically, you know. They were also at some point friends with the US. I think they were the only communist country that didn't boycott the US Olympic Games in 1984.
Oh, okay.
But then he weirdly decided to repay all the debt Romania had in the 80s. So, okay. Yeah, he didn't want his country to have debt. So he started repaying all the debt. But this means that economically, like, every output that they had, it had to go on to repaying that debt.
So is that responsible or irresponsible?
I mean, it's...
probably not popular.
Yeah. I mean, you could say it's responsible. But then it's like when your economic development is so bad, like focusing all your efforts to repaying your debt, maybe it's not the wisest thing, you know?
Yeah.
And Romania started to struggle a lot by the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s. And already in the 80s, yeah, the country was struggling a lot. And people started to voice, to have concerns about it. And, you know, in 1989, all the other communist regimes started falling apart slowly in Central Europe. And this was transitioning slowly in Eastern Europe. Bulgaria, for example, already in November, the communist regime fell. And in December 1989 in Timișoara, this is a western, one of the big Romanian cities, but it's located on the western, around the western part of Romania, there was a protest there. And this protest, the army was sent and they actually killed people. So there was a lot of violence happening. But this was in Timișoara, not in Bucharest.
Were protests and such things generally repressed in Romania?
Yes, they were, but no one expected that it would be so massively restricted, like involving the army, sending the army, killing people. It was not expected. But then this protest slowly moved to Bucharest, and this all happens like by the end of 1989, so this happens literally in terms of weeks and days. And then Ceaușescu was in Iran for a visit and he returned. So he didn't have any idea what was going on in Timișoara, actually.
Wow.
So he comes back to Bucharest and it's like...
So, sorry to interrupt you, but did he not actually order this repression himself then? Because he was abroad.
This was the regime.
The regime
that
did.
Decided to take this measure.
Mm.
And they're not talking to their leader?
I mean, I don't know what was the decision behind that, how it went. But from what I've read and researched was that the regime took care of the situation in Timișoara. And also, I mean, this was not... Also, there was a total media control. So what was happening there, people in the country didn't know. The only way they could hear about it was through Radio Free Europe, which was a way airing about it. But it was illegal listening to that radio, you know? So,
okay.
But anyway.
Is that the radio station that had that movie made about, that Romanian movie just made about them? I think the movie's called Metronome, or the radio was called Metronome.
Yeah.
About students having this radio station.
Yes,
under the Ceaușescu
listening
regime.
To it. Yeah.
And they were essentially...
I remember I watched a trailer, but I think it was about Radio Free Europe, yes. And this radio was broadcasted, I think from London, I'm not sure. But it was one of the very pro-Western radios in Central, and the people who were against the regime were listening in Central and Eastern Europe. My granddad was actually listening to that radio.
Wow.
And actually we had a... Lizanne, I don't know if you heard that story of a Bulgarian journalist being killed in London with an umbrella in the 60s.
Oh, yes, yeah.
He was a journalist working for that radio.
Oh, was
actually,
he?
Yeah, and...
Was it like a syringe hidden
yes,
in the...
Yes.
So he was like stabbed with
I
it.
I also heard of that, actually. Yeah. Yes. Is that to do with this radio?
Yes, he was working for that radio, yeah. And the KGB, basically. The KGB all together with the Bulgarian security services sent a guy to assassinate him.
Yeah, the...
Bulgaria was famous in the UK for longer due to that case, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did they just find Bulgarian spies there a few months ago as well?
They did. But actually, they did. But then it's like, I don't know how... I mean, yeah, they did.
It fell out of the news quite quickly though, didn't it?
It fell out of the news quite quickly. And it's like, I saw these guys, like, I mean, who knows? Maybe they were really spies, you know? But it's like, they seem these weird immigrants, you know, that They didn't seem like actually professional spies or something. Like, I don't know. Have you seen the pictures of them or read about them? Like, they seem like random Bulgarian immigrants, I don't know, doing random working class jobs and just like...
Yeah, they weren't like...
Yeah. Buying glass.
They weren't,
they weren't
like,
working for the government or anything prestigious. No, they were just like regular.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah.
Fair, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't
know. I just spy my free time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway... So Ceaușescu comes back from Iran and the revolt is already spreading to Bucharest. And weirdly, the Communist Party wanted somehow to assert, I don't know, its presence and to show that they're still legitimate, you know. So they decide that among this revolt happening around the country, they're like, okay, you know what, we have to organize a big rally. So that people can see that the average citizen still supports the Communist Party.
Okay.
Super stupid decision. So they organized that on the 21st of December. And basically, yeah, they summoned this citizen rally in Bucharest that has to show that citizens still support the party. It happens in front of the main party building. Ceaușescu stands on the balcony and addresses the crowd. And while he's speaking, something weird starts happening. Everybody starts to whistle, nobody's shouting party slogans, and everybody just shouting and whistling and being unhappy. And Ceaușescu starts saying, okay, we're gonna increase the wages that many percentage, we're gonna do this and that, you know, in order to calm them down. But nobody comes down, and this is all on national TV. The situation gets so fucking weird that they actually stop the broadcasting.
And
on YouTube, you can find the last speech of Ceaușescu, and you can see him visibly how he's getting worried, you know, that despite all these big statements, there is no reaction from the public and everybody is like still dissatisfied. And he just feels, you can see how nervous he feels, you know. Anyway, so they cut the broadcasting. This happens on 21st of December. Then on the following day, his wife, Elena, who is also a very controversial figure, like, we have to speak a lot about her. And him, they decide to flee Bucharest and they get on a helicopter. But the helicopter gets, the couple gets captured, unfortunately for them, 50 kilometers after Bucharest in another city called Târgoviște. So they capture them.
Okay.
And they are gonna spend their last days in a military base, locked. Because actually the Communist Party didn't know what to do with them. So there is a revolution going on. And the Communist Party, the people who organize the revolution, they capture the leader and they don't know what to do with him, you know. So they need to think about it a few days, you know. And while thinking about him, it's funny, I was reading that Ceaușescu showed a huge arrogance while being a hostage. Like, for example, the army... were giving them food in metal cups and plates, and they were super unpleased, Ceaușescu together with his wife, because they were just to eat only in China plates, you know.
Oh my god.
Priorities.
Yeah, yeah. He was shocked that officers would get him such low class meals. And yeah,
so he didn't realize quite how much trouble he was in then. He kind of
until the end they didn't imagine that this thing would happen.
Yeah, that's the fast turnaround though, from because that's what you said, the 21st or something was when they fled.
It was the rally, 22nd he flees, they catch him, and then they put him in this military base. He's locked until they decide what to do. And I don't know, while reading about it, like, it kind of reminded me about the Russian Tsar's killing.
That's just what I was thinking. Because, it's similar vibes.
Yeah, they, again, catch him. Obviously, the Russian, the Nikolai II's case is a bit prolonged, you know, they have him for many months. But still, the communists back then didn't know what to do with him, you know, like, same here, they didn't know what to do with him for a few days. But then, basically, they decide to kill him. So they organize a trial, which begins on Christmas Day, and it lasts less than an hour.
Less than an hour?
Less than an hour, yes, yes. And they deliver the verdict after only 5 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So, and the trial is video recorded.
What kind of things was he accused of?
Genocide, basically. Yeah. And in the New Yorker, there is an article from 1989 that you can see a bit of transcript from the session. It's absurd. Like, they ask him, like, there is no documents there. The only thing you can see is basically like an empty desk, you know, and someone just accusing him of some stuff, you know. They're probably valid stuff, but they're just accusing him of, why did you deprive Romanians of food, let's say, or why the economic situation is so bad? You are guilty for that, you know. Did you kill any citizens? You know, but nothing official, formal, no letters, nothing. And they just, yeah.
No, like, evidence. No, it's evidence, just them nothing. Telling.
Super unprofessional, super informal, yeah. And it's kind of, I don't know, sad also, because while reading for it, like, I think at some moment they realize where this is going. And Ceaușescu, Nicolae, he realizes that, and he starts touching his wife's, Elena's hand, you know, knowing that. I mean, she just looks down, you know. But he's like, he realizes that, okay, this is going to end bad, you know. And he tries to calm her down, you know. But it's, the situation is absurd. And the interesting thing, again, the similarity with the Russian Tsar's death is that, again, if I'm not wrong, the people who killed Nikolai, they didn't know until the end that the Tsar is inside, you know, they were just last minute informed.
Yeah.
Same happens here. The people sent there to kill him, actually, they applied for a secret mission that's going to happen in Christmas, but they didn't know who actually are they going to kill, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And actually, when they go inside, I think only, they send three people, I think only one manages to shoot properly. One of them freezes. The other one's Kalashnikov doesn't work on automatic regime. And just the third guy's Kalashnikov is well functioning. And yeah. So yeah, actually everybody watched the execution except the chief judge who gave the verdict.
He didn't.
He didn't watch it.
He didn't watch it.
And he suicided.
Oh, really?
Later, yeah. I mean, a decade later or something like
that.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, they started shooting and they killed him. But then the video was not working.
Wait, they live streamed the shooting?
Wait, the video was not working. So they didn't live stream the shooting. They wanted to live stream
it. They wanted to live stream the shooting?
They wanted to, okay, not live stream. They want to record the shooting, I guess. But the camera was not working. So after they killed him, they put again the camera, and in YouTube you can see again the video. They're lying dead on the floor, Nikolai and Elena, and you hear gun sounds, but these gun sounds are just like, they're already dead, you know, but they've put the camera to record their gun sounds.
Oh god,
people are still lying. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's mad.
This whole thing is horrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this happens on the 25th of December, actually. And yeah, Romania celebrate Christmas on 25th of December.
Oh my god.
And
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. And that's the weird thing, because
and they were killed on the same day they were tried. Like, the trial was earlier in the day.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah, they
killed them, they like killed there them. And then. So, they didn't even wait until the next day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Brutal.
Yeah. And when I was a student, I remember speaking with a Romanian classmate of mine, and this was early 2010s. Bulgaria and Romania just joined the EU, but still like very poor, you know, compared to other European countries. And it was like, oh, maybe like there was this notion of that God kind of, or I don't know, destiny kind of has something about Romania because they killed Ceaușescu, or that guy, you know, on Christmas. Like, it's having such a vengeance, you know, happening on Christmas Day. It's God's Day, you know. Obviously, that's
like, it kind of cursed them.
Yeah, yeah, it has nothing to do with reality, obviously, but it kind of showed, I think, for a few years, probably, how Romanians kind of felt about it. Like, I think there is this, from what I've read, I think there is this, I don't know, ambiguous feeling of, okay, we've had this revolution, we celebrate the revolution, but in the same time, we've killed in such a barbaric way that person, you know? And it's one of the few countries, actually, that had a difficult transition had such a bloody transition from communism, you know, because in Hungary, in Poland, in Bulgaria, it went quite, you don't speak about Yugoslavia, you know, but but it went, Soviet Union, quite smooth, you know, no bloodshed, nothing, but
Romania just had
it didn't go well, yeah, and there are also these discussions now whether this was actually a revolution of the people or it was a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
Talks because a lot of the communist nomenclatura stayed in power after the revolution.
Mm.
A lot of this also, yeah, actually the army organized all that. And the army was at some moment, as I said earlier, they were trying to suppress the revolt, you know?
Yeah.
And in the same time, after some days, they joined the people who were protesting. So there, I guess we can say that probably it was both. I think there was probably... It was probably in a way coup d'etat, but also it was in a way, I don't know, a mass protest against the situation in Romania back then.
Yeah, but they could have very easily escaped abroad and then just lived in exile for the rest of their days.
I guess they probably tried, but they couldn't.
Yeah. That's not the way things worked out.
Yeah. But now, I would say, because I was reading this thing while preparing that, again, these notions of Romanians feeling a bit cursed, you know, due to that situation. And the article that I read was in 2009. And what I said with this Romanian friend that we spoke was again 2011-12. Well, I think, I don't know if that's present nowadays because, I mean, Romania has had a very good development in the last years. Like, I think it has bigger GDP now than Greece. Like it has economically, has surpassed Greece, has surpassed Bulgaria. Bulgaria and Romania joined together in the EU. Romania is now more advanced. Yeah, I think the country, despite all its problems, you know, it's doing okay.
Well, yeah, what a period of history to sort of overcome to get to where you are now. So,
yeah,
for sure. Jeepers, a bit heavy that one.
Yeah.
Izan, over to you. Can you lift us up a bit?
Well, yeah, mine's slightly more cheery, considering it's not to do with death this time. So there is some light maiming, but no death. So
some light what?
Maiming. We'll get there. So I'm talking about the coronation of Charlemagne. So Charlemagne, the king of the Franks. The Franks being a kind of conglomerate of modern day France and parts of Germany, large portions of Germany actually, and he became the emperor of a large portion of Europe, of Western Europe, which is why he was he had this coronation to make him emperor. So it wasn't just that he was being crowned as king, he was crowned as emperor on Christmas Day in the year 800. So you might remember from our previous discussions about the western part of the Roman Empire and the eastern part of the Roman Empire and how kind of they had their whole schism, and the west then was attacked by the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, etc., and there were all the kind of Gothic wars, and the Roman Empire in the west fell from power, so it kind of then just became ruled by for the Goths for a while, and a series of rulers who weren't Christian. A lot of them were pagan groups and peoples, so they didn't practice Christianity. So this was kind of a big issue for the Pope, among many other people. So there was kind of a bit of a power vacuum going on. The Eastern Roman Empire had tried to intervene, and they had regained parts of Italy, but then Italy had kind of fallen to the Lombards after that. So it had been this whole tumult of different political issues, wars, etc., that had been going for a little while over the early part of the kind of 400s AD through to the 800s. So Charlemagne, he was the son of the King of the Franks. So he was the son of Pepin the Short. A bit of an unfortunate epitaph, but Pepin. So Pepin died, and he left his kingdom to his two sons, Carolus, or Charles, as he might be known to us, and his other son as well, who was called Carloman. But Carloman died suddenly in 771, so everything then became Charles's, Carolus's. So he took over the entire empire at that point. So he was born in modern day Belgium, and when he took over the empire he decided, because he was a Christian king, he decided that he wanted to regain Christian territories. He was a very successful warrior and conqueror. So he spent the early part of his reign on military campaigns to expand his kingdom. He invaded Saxony. He achieved the total conquest and conversion to Christianity of kind of those German lands. And then he went to the northern Italy and took over the Lombards territories. He even invaded northern Spain and took that from the Moors and the Saracens. So he had a huge expanding empire at this point over the kind of late portion of the 700s, kind of around 770s, 780s. And then he added Bohemia to his empire. Yeah, he just basically kept going. So he was this force that couldn't be stopped of Christian conquering across Western Europe. And at the same time, there was a bit of an issue going on with the Pope. So the Pope still in Rome at this point, but so the Pope who was in power, who was Hadrian I, had died, not Hadrian the Emperor of our Roman law, but Hadrian the Pope. So he had died, and the guy who'd taken over from him was called Leo the Third, and Leo was not a nobleman. So this rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way, because Hadrian had been from this big kind of aristocratic family and was very powerful, and the people who, you know, were his peers thought that this lowly Leo taking over was just like bad taste, and they didn't they didn't appreciate that. So they were trying to overthrow him, and this is where the maiming comes in. So in 799, some assailants came and they tried, well, they captured the Pope Leo the Third, and they tried to mutilate him so that he could no longer be Pope. Wow. Yeah. Oh, so they like gouged at his eyes and apparently cut out his tongue, because at that time, if you were like maimed physically in that way, then you could no longer hold a position of power because you weren't whole to God. And this happened a lot in the Byzantine Empire as well, where if you weren't kind of whole, then you couldn't maintain your position. But there was not quite Christmas, but Christian miracle, in that he came through it and he regained his sight and he regained the ability to speak. Oh. So either they botched the job, or they spread the story that they'd done it and they hadn't, or he, who knows, Christmas miracle, let's go with that. Yeah. He regained his sight, he regained the ability to speak, and he maintained his power. But he then needed to make an alliance, because he had all these people against him. The Lombards were still kind of scouting around the edges, so he needed someone to kind of have his back. And so he approaches Charles Carolus, the great Christian king who's conquering all these lands, who's doing all this stuff to kind of you know, back up the Christian empires across Western Europe. Leo went to Charlemagne for support, and they came together and kind of hatched a plan, although later sources would say that Charlemagne had no idea what was going on. He was completely oblivious, and, you know, all of this was just done by the Pope. So at the same time as this, just for a bit of a political context, in the Eastern Roman Empire, another maiming was going on, because there was Irene was the empress at that time. She didn't feel like her son was up to the task of being emperor. So when he inherited the throne, she had him physically maimed.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and blinded, so that he couldn't take the throne. And so she gained the power. Her own son.
That's like a toxic mom.
Yeah, very toxic mom. Yeah, very rude. So not great mumming on her part, but, you know, so that also gave the Western Roman Empire, as they liked to think of it, you know, inheritors of the Christian Roman kind of vibe going on, they were like, well, she's not even an emperor, she's a woman, how could she even be an emperor? So they were like, well, there's a power vacuum now, there's this, they, we need a Christian emperor in place, and we don't have one in the East, so that means we have to get one back in the West. So along comes Christmas Day on the year 800, and Charles is invited to Rome to celebrate with the Pope. And so they go to the Basilica, to St. Peter's Basilica, and they have their Christmas Mass there. very holy day, very holy kind of everything that's going on. And out of nowhere, the Pope grabs a crown, pops it on Charles's head, and names him the Emperor of all of the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, there are sources to say that Charles was already like dressed in Roman garb, and they had some people turn up with like a holy banner from Jerusalem at the same time. So it was like, oh, what great timing that all these people are having. What a surprise party. Yeah, so he probably knew what was going on, but the sources who wrote about him said he had no idea. He wouldn't have even gone to the church that day. Yeah. He had no idea. So yeah, he was crowned. And again, just to show how unprepared this was, the Roman people who were in attendance all cheered en masse in unison to the August Charles, crowned by God, the great and peaceful emperor of the Romans. Life and victory. Just, you know, completely spontaneous act of cheering there.
In beautiful unison.
Yeah. So they cheered that three times and he was crowned as the emperor of all of the Roman Christians. And although his family, the Carolingians, quickly fell out of power a few generations later because he divided up his empire between his sons, as that seemed to be the thing that they did back then, rather than one person inheriting, you would just divide the kingdom. And of course, they all fell out amongst each other and that all kind of fell away. But the idea of the Holy Roman Emperor is the same one that goes all the way through, you know, the Spanish kings, through the German kings, and through the Habsburgs, all the way through to the 1800s. So that idea of having a Holy Roman Emperor who is invested with this power by the Pope became completely central to the way that Western Europe continued from there on out.
Yeah.
And other kings who came after him also kind of echoed this. So when William the Conqueror in England was crowned in 1066, he also chose his ceremony to be on Christmas Day and kind of...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, okay. He emulated a lot of the same things. And then even Napoleon, when Napoleon came to power and crowned himself emperor, he also kind of reenacted this whole scene because it was such an important part of the history of France. So, yeah. Okay,
so he did something quite iconic.
Yeah, he was an icon. He was, So, yeah, slightly more cheery. Less death.
Bang, two celebrations in one. Love it.
Yeah.
Christmas coronation.
Yeah, exactly. And like big feast day for everyone.
Good for the budget as well.
Rather than two. Handing out all of those like feasts. Be like, oh no, we'll just combine that.
All right, so we've taken you through a bit of a walk through some iconic / devastating events on Christmas Day. The glue wine's hit our heads a bit. It's hit mine. Apologies if I'm slurring or something. But I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I know we've gone a bit grim to non-grim to medium grim, like a whole range of grims. But I hope you took something from it, whether it be... the 90s in the communist world or the coronation on Christmas Day vibe that continues to be iconic into later years.
Yeah.
So hope you enjoy. I hope you haven't gotten sick of our voices. This is our first and last episode this year. But like we said, this year's been a bit of a sham in a good way for all of us in our professional lives. But we have now worked out a way how to keep this going and we'll be coming to you more regularly in the very, very near future, I promise.
We've got some good episodes lined up actually, so.
We've left our best work for now.
Yeah, definitely. Make promises.
Yeah, let's not make promises. Maybe we'll be back in 5 years in the near future. Good, it's not defined. Anyway,
But yeah, eat lots, but don't be sick.
Drink lots, but don't be sick.
Watch some Christmas movies.
And of course, if you found anything particularly interesting about what we discussed today, because we obviously went through three different topics in a very brief form, let us know. We can elaborate in a further episode on one of these topics. And of course, if you have any topics you'd like us to discuss, please let us know on all our social media platforms.
at Museums Mojitos on Instagram and Twitter, and the podcast's full name on Facebook.
Yes.
Okay. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, guys.
Bye. Bye.